And it came to pass, when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, to the king of Shimron, to the king of Achshaph, and to the kings who were from the north, in the mountains, in the plain south of Chinneroth, in the lowland, and in the heights of Dor on the west, to the Canaanites in the east and in the west, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite in the mountains, and the Hivite below Hermon in the land of Mizpah. So they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude, with very many horses and chariots. And when all these kings had met together, they came and camped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. But Yahweh said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow about this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." So Joshua and all the people of war with him came against them suddenly by the waters of Merom, and they attacked them. And Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them to greater Sidon, to the brook Mizrephoth, and to the valley of Mizpah eastward. They attacked them until they left none of them remaining. So Joshua did to them as Yahweh had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Joshua turned back at that time and took Hazor and struck its king with the sword. For Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. And they struck all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. Then he burned Hazor with fire. So all the cities of those kings and all their kings Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them, as Moses the servant of Yahweh had commanded. But as for the cities that stood on their mounds, Israel burned none of them except Hazor only, which Joshua burned. And all the spoil of these cities and the livestock the children of Israel took as booty for themselves. But they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them, and they left none breathing. As Yahweh had commanded Moses his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that Yahweh had commanded Moses. Thus Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, all the land of Goshen, the lowland, and the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel and its lowlands, from Mount Halak and the ascent to Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All the others they took in battle. For it was of Yahweh to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them, as Yahweh had commanded Moses. And at that time Joshua came and cut off the Anakim from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. None of the Anakim were left in the land of the children of Israel. They remained only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that Yahweh had said to Moses. And Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Then the land rested from war. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. Joshua 10 recorded the Israelite conquest of the southern portion of the promised land. And this is followed by Joshua 11's account of the northern conquest. We're going to explore this passage following a three-part outline, looking first at the northern opponents in verses 1 through 5, secondly at the northern victory in verses 6 through 15, and finally a review of the conquest in verses 16 through 23. Northern opponents, northern victory, review of the conquest. We begin with the northern opponents. The chapter opens, "Now it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things." So the city mentioned here is Hazor. It was a very significant city with an area of 200 acres and an estimated population of 40,000. It was the largest city in Canaan at the time. It was a major commercial center. It lay on a trade route that linked Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Syria. Thus, its king Jabin was a major power broker. And our chapter begins with King Jabin hearing about the Israelite victories in the south. He doesn't want to see such a conquest in the north. And so he goes into action. Like Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem in the south, Jabin, king of Hazor, forms a military coalition to oppose Israel's forces. Listen again to the verses that describe this coalition, starting with verse 1. Now it came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard these things, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, to the king of Shimron, to the king of Akshaph, and to the kings who were from the north in the mountains, in the plain, south of Chinneroth. Chinneroth is the Sea of Galilee. In the lowland and in the heights of Dor on the west, to the Canaanites in the east and in the west, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite in the mountains, and the Hivite below Hermon in the land of Mizpah. So they went out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude, with very many horses and chariots. Now these verses go into detail about all these cities that were brought into the coalition to make the point that together they were quite a formidable foe for Israel. And we don't actually know the exact location of all the cities that are mentioned here, but from those that we do know, it's clear that they cover the entire portion of the northern part of the land, looking from the south to the north and from the east to the west. The armies united in this coalition contain a great many soldiers. Verse 4 says they are as many people as the sand that is on the seashore in multitude. Now that was a common form of hyperbole in the ancient Near East, but it pointed to a vast, vast number. And the coalition army also had the best military technology. We're told they had very many horses and chariots. This was not a force that you would want to face in battle. But battle is why this massive force was formed. Verse 5, and when all these kings had met together, they came and camped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. It's their very reason for being as a coalition of forces. Now before we move on to Israel's response, let's note one more thing about this coalition. Verse 3 notes a number of peoples: the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, and the Hivites. And all of those together were mentioned in a previous passage in the Pentateuch. And it's a chapter that anticipates what we're reading now. It's Exodus 23. And we read in Exodus 23:23, Yahweh speaking to the people, "For my angel will go before you and bring you in to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off." Yahweh had promised his angel would go before Israel, granting them victory over just these inhabitants of the land. The formidable foe was a coalition of people that Israel was called to destroy and over which Israel had been promised victory. So we turn next to consider that northern victory as we find it in verses 6 through 15. Joshua 11:5 presents this force encamped in preparation to fight Israel. And verse 6 shifts to Israel, beginning with the word from the Lord. "But Yahweh said to Joshua, 'Do not be afraid because of them.'" Now Joshua had heard these words before, "Do not be afraid." He heard them in his initial call to leadership of the nation in chapter 1, verse 9. He heard it just prior to the second attack on Ai in chapter 8, verse 1. He himself had spoken these words to the Israelite captains when he called them to go forward and to place their feet upon the necks of the defeated kings in the south in chapter 10, verse 25. Yahweh had proved faithful after previous calls not to be afraid. And this memory surely would have encouraged Joshua and all Israel in the face of the huge army opposing them. And the call to resist fear is linked with a divine promise of victory, really bringing forward that promise of Exodus 23 into the present of Joshua's days. And the Lord says, "For tomorrow, about this time, I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." What a relief. Yahweh will deliver the enemy slain before Israel. so they could just sit back, right? They could just wait for the dead bodies to be brought up and rolled out before them. They could let go and let God. Well, no, that is not their attitude at all. As we have seen before, divine sovereignty employs human action. It doesn't negate it. Divine sovereignty employs human action. It doesn't negate it. Though Yahweh promised victory, Israel still had to go into battle, still had to fight for that victory. Let us never presume upon God as if His sovereign promises eliminate our call to obedience. Yes, He has His elect, but we are called to evangelize. Yes, He promises to preserve His elect, but we are called to persevere in the faith. Calvinism is not fatalism and inaction. Now, that's a straw man sometimes erected in the name of Calvinism, but again, divine sovereignty employs human action. It doesn't negate it. Indeed, the fact of divine sovereignty should motivate us to step out in obedience and faith, even when the odds seem to be against us. We are called to live by faith, not by sight. And this is exactly what Joshua led the Israelite forces to do against the extremely powerful and well-equipped northern armies. Verse 7. So Joshua and all the people of war with him came against them suddenly by the waters of Merom, and they attacked them. The sudden nature of the Israelite attack may point to a surprise attack under the cover of darkness, like happened at the beginning of the southern campaign. The attack came by the waters of Merom, where the enemy was encamped. It is likely that the northern forces had encamped here but had planned to move further onto the plains to actually engage in an attack themselves. We know from other ancient sources that sometimes when armies came from hilly land and mountainous areas with chariots, they actually had the chariot sort of disassembled and packed up, and they would get to the field, and when they got to the place of attack, they would assemble those chariots and then go forward. It's possible, though we don't know for certain, that that was the case here. Perhaps they were caught before they even had their chariots assembled. That would be sort of the tanks of their day. Whether that was the case or not, Israel was victorious. It was when Israel acted in faith and attacked that the Lord delivered their enemies into their hands. We read in verses 8 and 9, "And Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and chased them to greater Sidon, to the brook Mizrephath, to the valley of Mizpah eastward, and they attacked them until they left none of them remaining. So Joshua did to them as Yahweh had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire." On the back of your handout, you have a map that shows some of the route that was used for this. At the bottom, that's where they're coming up from the south, and Merom was the place of the initial attack, and then they chased them to different places in different directions. Now, we're told that they hamstrung the horses. Hamstringing a horse involved making the animal militarily useless by cutting the large tendon at the back of the knee on the hind legs. Now, that may sound vicious to us, certainly would to PETA, but it was the nature of warfare in that day. It would be perhaps the equivalent of disabling the treads on the tanks in modern warfare. And they did this, and they burned the chariots at the command of Yahweh. Well, that does raise a question. Why didn't they simply take the horses and chariots for their own use? Well, the most clear answer, of course, is that the Lord told them not to, and they obeyed the Lord. But it may be that He did give that command because He wanted them to continue to rely on Him and not on military might for their future victories. This would be in accord with David's later statement in Psalm 20, verse 7. "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of Yahweh our God." Well, the victory was complete. Verse 8, they attacked them until they left none of them remaining. And this follows the principles of holy warfare, that harem warfare that we've reviewed previously in this series. We see the same principles of that at work in Joshua's treatment of Hazor and its king, verses 10 and 11. Joshua turned back at that time and took Hazor and struck its king with the sword. For Hazor was formerly the head of all those kingdoms. Remember, that was the big power center city. And they struck all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was none left breathing. Then he burned Hazor with fire. So in the case of Hazor, its king and all of its inhabitants were killed by the sword, and the city was destroyed by fire. This was what happened beforehand in Jericho and in Ai. Again, Hazor was the great power city of the north, and it was utterly decimated by Israel. Other cities in the coalition, however, were not so completely destroyed. They were not burned. Starting at verse 12, so all the cities of those kings, those other kings, and all their kings Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, had commanded. But as for the cities that stood on their mounds, Israel burned none of them except Hazor only, which Joshua burned. And all the spoil of these cities and the livestock, the children of Israel took as booty for themselves. But they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them, and they left none breathing. The only cities recorded as being burned in the conquest are Jericho, Ai, and Hazor. And remember, in Ai, the people were allowed to plunder the city before its destruction. The principles of holy warfare did not require the physical destruction of all the cities. Indeed, the law envisioned Israel occupying cities they had conquered, not rebuilding all of them from the ground up. We read this in Deuteronomy 6, verses 10 and 11. So it shall be when Yahweh your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of all good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. So the picture was not just of military victory, it was actually of coming and dwelling in a land, taking over the good houses, the wells, the livestock, the provisions that were already there. So while the inhabitants of the cities of the northern kings were wiped out, all the spoil of these cities and the livestock of the children of Israel, they took as booty for themselves. And again, this is part of the fulfillment of that picture, that vision that was painted in Deuteronomy 6. It was another sign of Yahweh's faithfulness. And the text leaves no doubt that Joshua carried out all these things in obedience to the Lord. Verse 15, as Yahweh had commanded Moses his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that Yahweh had commanded Moses. Remember at the very beginning of the book, there was sort of a question hanging in the air. Moses had died. Would Joshua be able to fill his shoes? Would Joshua be able to lead the people as Moses did? And here we see him doing that. As verse 15, Yahweh commanded Moses, Moses commanded Joshua, and Joshua did everything that the Lord had commanded him. I wish that could be my epitaph. It can't be. And I wasn't, I'm sure, perfect for Joshua either. But what a wonderful thing. He left nothing undone of all that Yahweh had commanded Moses. He is indeed a faithful leader in the footsteps of Moses. Well, that brings us to the third portion here, the review of the conquest in verses 16 through 23. So now in chapters 10 and 11, and even in the previous chapters of entering into the land and those earlier victories, the conquest in the north and south and in the central portion of the land has been given in some detail, and this text now gives a summary. Verses 16 through 18, then Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, all the land of Goshen, the lowland and the Jordan plain, the mountains of Israel and its lowlands, from Mount Halak in the ascent to Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Joshua made war a long time with all these kings. One of the things these verses tell us is that the accounts of the campaign in the north and south that were recorded for us in previous chapters are not exhaustive. there's cities, there's places mentioned in this little summary that were not included there. A commentator, Ralph Davis, reminds us, the conquest then was a long, grueling, demanding process. Joshua 2 through 11 rightly gives you the highlights, but you must not think it was merely one hot summer's work. When you study all the passages in the history of Israel, it seems that the conquest of the land probably took 5 to 7 years in totality. So we got some snapshots of some of the key battles, but it was an extended process, as the text says. And this is also in accord with prior prophecy in Exodus 23. We quoted from that earlier. Now, Exodus 23:29 says, the Lord speaking, I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. There was even good reason why they just didn't have sort of instant victory in the land, that they didn't take the land all in one campaign or all in 1 year. It was a long process. It required ongoing faith and obedience. And we too are called to endurance, faithfully obeying while we wait for some deliverance or for some blessing from the Lord. Verse 19 reminds us that the Gibeonites who had made a covenant with Israel were the only ones who were spared in the conquest. All the others Israel took in battle. And this statement of what Israel did is followed immediately by another statement of God's sovereignty in the matter. Verse 20, for it was of Yahweh to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as Yahweh had commanded Moses. Here we see that involved in this is Yahweh hardening the hearts of the dwellers in the land of Canaan, and particularly that he might lead Israel to destroy them. Now, this is another sort of echo of the Exodus account and the time in Israel when we read that Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart. But an interesting study is to look at that language through the book of Exodus, because sometimes it says Yahweh hardens Pharaoh's heart, and other times it says Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And you get both of those several times in the book. I think a key to understanding how Yahweh often hardens the hearts of people is what we see in Romans chapter 1. You know, that's the chapter we reflected upon it a good bit in our adult Sunday school class, where the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And what does God do? Verse 24. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Verse 26, for this reason God gave them up to vile passions. Verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. Sometimes, if people don't say to God, thy will be done, God says to them, okay, thy will be done. And he takes back any restraint upon them, and he allows them to go in their sinful ways, and they bear the consequences of that sin. And such was the case with the people in Canaan, that the Lord hardened their hearts. Whether that was an active act of confirming something that was already there or simply allowing them to go their pagan ways, the result was the people's utter destruction at the hands of Israel. Again, a combination of divine sovereignty and human action. Well, that brings us to verses 21 and 22. And at that time, Joshua came and cut off the Anakim from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. None of the Anakim were left in the land of the children of Israel. They remained only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod. You know, this is something additional to the conquest accounts that we've read in the previous chapters, and I think it's so appropriate that we find it here. The Anakim, I love Ralph Davis's description of them. He says they were the incredible hawks of the land of Canaan. The incredible hawks, you know, that big green guy. Well, they were big. I'm sure they weren't green. But we read of them in a significant passage in Numbers chapter 13. This is back when Israel came to the edge of the land the first time, and the spies were sent into the land. And we read in Numbers 13:28, the report of most of the spies was, "Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there." And then we go on in verses 31 to 33, "But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw there are men of great stature. There we saw the giants. The descendants of Anak came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight." You see, earlier when they came to the edge of the land and the spies went in, it was in part, their fear of the Anakim, the fear of these great giants in the land that led the people to refuse to enter the land. Now, not all the spies gave that report, did they? Who were the two spies who did not give that evil report? Joshua and Caleb. And here is Joshua. And Israel, who had feared the Anakim and had failed to listen to Joshua earlier, now we're told, under Joshua's faithful leadership, the Anakim are cut off and utterly destroyed. The Lord could have done that the first time if they had been faithful, if they'd been believing, if they would have gone into the land. But how wonderful that Joshua, who had given that faithful report and said, "The Lord can do it," is then used by the Lord to do exactly that and to defeat those great giants in the land that the people so feared in the earlier generation. Now, there were Anakim outside the land of Canaan. We're told that they only remained in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod. So, children, the Bible later tells us about a giant who came from Gath. Do you know who he was? Goliath. Goliath was a giant who came from Gath. Most likely, he is a descendant of Anak. He is one of the Anakim. Outside the land, all the ones in the land were destroyed, but he shows up again later in history. And like those previous Anakim, he also is destroyed by the Lord, using another servant, David. So what we see in this chapter is a beautiful picture of Yahweh's sovereignty and his covenant faithfulness on display in the context. Again, we look back at some of those previous passages in Exodus and in Deuteronomy where the Lord had told the people just what he was calling them to do and how he was going to bless their efforts and grant them the victory. And they, in obedience and faithfulness, did their part, and the Lord blessed them and gave them the victory. With our eyes fixed on King Jesus, we need the faith and faithfulness of Joshua and the people who faithfully served under him. We too have the assurance of God's presence with us. I want to close by reading to you the first stanza of the hymn that we'll close our service with, because I think it expresses this idea very well in terms that apply to us. The hymn is entitled, "Who Trusts in God a Strong Abode." And it begins, "Who trusts in God a strong abode in heaven and earth possesses. Who looks in love to Christ above, no fear his heart oppresses. In you alone, dear Lord, we own sweet hope and consolation. Our shield from foes, our balm for woes, our great and sure salvation." Again, we can keep in mind what we've read tonight when we sing that hymn later on. But in Christ, we have the same kind of fortress, we have the same kind of refuge, we have the same kind of strength and promise of victory that Israel had under